This is City Road, produced out of the 2SER studios in Sydney and coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network.
The COVID-19 pandemic has provided a hopefully once-in-a-generation opportunity to fix the structural and systemic problems of housing that have always been here in Australia.
Think that a housing crisis is an individual person's problem. And I think what's really interesting and important about COVID is that it's drawn into sharp relief the fact that a housing crisis is a community problem and not just an individual problem.
Hi there, welcome to City Road Podcast. My name's Sam and I'm here with Ursula.
Hello.
And we've taken over the podcast this episode to talk about some of the issues of renting during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, so Sam and I are both students at the University of Technology Sydney, which is just down the road from Sydney University, and we're both renters at the moment. And so we thought it was appropriate to kick Dallas out of the studio for this episode because Dallas is a homeowner and it didn't seem appropriate for him to be talking about this.
Yeah, so over the past couple of months, we've been speaking to a variety of different perspectives, whether it be academics, renters, the New South Wales Tenants Union, and we've just been trying to wrap our heads around the issue because it is something that's very close to our personal lives as well, not only in just a theoretical sense.
So the first person we spoke to was Dr. Emma Power from Western Sydney University, and Emma spoke to us about the role of secure housing as being the first step in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic.
Look, secure housing's the first line of community defence against the pandemic, and it's a prerequisite for people who need to go into quarantine or who need to self-isolate. So it protects individuals, but it also keeps the community as a whole at safe. But to be secure, the housing that we have needs to meet a few requirements. So it needs to be affordable, but it also needs to give people secure occupancy. And so that basically means people need to have the right to stay in that housing as long as they wish to. Our housing needs to be of a reasonable standard. It needs to be appropriate to the needs of the household. And it also needs to be well ventilated and not overcrowded. And so many Australians have got housing that meets these standards, but there's growing numbers of households who don't. And this places the community as a whole at greater risk. And so renters are one group who are at a particularly elevated risk of not having secure housing. And older low-income renters, and particularly those who live alone, are at a much greater risk again.
And I was wanting to ask about those specific sort of rental demographics that you consider to be the most vulnerable. So who are those demographics and why do you consider them to be more at risk in scenarios such as this?
Look, single older women are quite invisible within this housing crisis. There's been a lot of talk in recent years about how they are the fastest growing group of homeless people in the country, but they tend to be less visible. We tend to think of homeless people as being older men who are sleeping rough on the street. We think about youth homelessness, but this group tend to be hanging on by their teeth to the very insecure housing that they've got. And they often don't know what support services they can access, and there are very few support services that are set up to target this group. And so we find that they will tend to, you know, do the best that they can to hang on to their rental accommodation. And when that starts to fall apart, they'll do things like couch surfing or sleeping in bedrooms of friends. They might cycle between different houses and so on, which of course puts them at greater risk in this period of the pandemic. And so they're much less visible and they haven't been much of a focus within much of the policy that we've seen thus far.
And just circling back to policy again, what's another sort of, I don't know, broad policy agenda of our government that's kind of put housing in such a precarious situation that it is now?
Look, the focus of this government, many governments over time in Australia, has been on secure home ownership. That's been seen as a really important social policy that's strongly connected with well-being and retirement. So things like the aged pension calculation, they actually assume that people are homeowners when they retire. Now, if you're a renter, you're in quite a different situation. You won't have paid off your housing while you're working. You'll still be paying housing costs at a market rate while you're retired. And so that eats up huge amounts of the pension, and particularly if you're a single pension owner.
Yeah, I was also wondering if you think that COVID has provided a unique visibility to some of these pre-existing issues, and if you're a little bit concerned that once things go back to business as usual, some of this might get covered up again.
It's very easy to think that a housing crisis is an individual person's problem. And I think what's really interesting and important about COVID is that it's drawn into sharp relief the fact that a housing crisis is a community problem and not just an individual problem. And so we've seen that playing out in Melbourne, but we've also seen it playing out in many other countries around the world, where people who live in insecure housing, who live in housing that's overcrowded, those people have been at greater risk initially of the pandemic. But then ultimately, if it takes hold in those sorts of households and communities, the community as a whole is at greater risk. And so what COVID is showing us is how we're all connected and how the inequality of some people is actually an inequality that affects us all.
I think it was really interesting talking to Emma about the role of secure housing, because I'd never even thought of how important that is as the first step to fight against COVID-19, because of course we need secure housing and safe housing, because without that, how are we going to have people staying at home and fighting the pandemic?
Yeah, definitely. And her speaking on the position of older female renters, it really reminded me of a conversation that we had with Catherine Skipper, who is a tenant down at the Waterloo Public Housing Estates.
So we're down here in Waterloo between the two high-rise public housing towers with Catherine. I was wondering if you could introduce yourself.
My name's Catherine Skipper and I live in Matavai, one of the towers, and I've lived here for 10 years in Waterloo. Before I actually came to public housing in Waterloo, people said to me what a ghastly place Waterloo was, and they told me these stories about, oh, how you'd be frightened to go out and so forth. And I was frightened too. But when I came here, you know, like almost the very first hour or so I was here, I realised that there was nothing scary about Waterloo, and it was a very nice place to live. You know, there's a very strong community. And as soon as I moved in, people sort of offered help. And then there was this beautiful green that we're looking at now. Plenty of dogs running around.
But do you think there are some very, I don't know, different public perceptions of a place like this compared to the actual reality of it?
Oh, yes. I think most of the public perceptions are probably owing to the Daily Telegraph and their alarmist language, mainly featuring drugs. Drugs.
Yeah. Do you feel as though, like, public housing residents do face quite a bit of stigma from the general public? I mean, have you had any personal experiences with that?
Well, I face a double stigma, really, because not only do I live in public housing, I'm 84. I'm old. So, you know, people have ways of letting you know that you're value is less once you become old. Well, they make assumptions about your health. Can you hear? I mean, people often speak really loudly to me. I mean, I can hear perfectly. I can hear perfectly well.
I was just wondering as well, how has the pandemic affected your life, especially in regard to public housing?
Well, at first, you know, I think everybody was confused by COVID-19 and its various names, and didn't quite know what it meant. I mean, I think that it implied right across the board. I don't think the government knew really what it meant, or they seemed not to. So I think people in general were slow to take action. I felt that if I took the right precautions and I wore a mask, I would had a, you know, a good chance of being protected, and I didn't go on public transport and blah, blah, blah. Mm. That if I took all these steps, I would be reasonably protected. But, you know, you have to think, well, you are old and your immune system is less. You know, you're going to die sometime soon.
Is there a large proportion of elderly people at this estate?
Well, in the two towers, yes, they're all elderly people. Fairly soon after the pandemic was announced, notices went up, you know, on the front door, on the intervening doors, And people were advised to wear masks, and many people did, many people didn't. And it really wasn't until 2 weeks ago, I think, people began receiving masks from the City of Sydney in the mail.
I mean, do you think that something like the pandemic exposes how important something like public housing is in that regard?
Yes, because it creates a crisis, doesn't it? And then that crisis shows up, there's immense holes. One would be nursing homes where the elderly reside, and then also the number of homeless. I mean, there was already a massive number of homeless people prior to the pandemic.
So do you think if we were to invest in more public housing options, it'd be a lot easier to house some of those people as well in general?
Yes, I do think that. And I think if we were to invest in public housing, well, it would be one way of offering employment too, wouldn't it?
After speaking with Catherine, we decided to catch up with Dr. Alastair Sasson, who's an expert in public housing.
Currently, I'm a research associate at the City Futures Research Centre at UNSW. My work there is quite varied, and partly I'm working on these issues of rental affordability and the quality of rental housing.
Yeah, I also understand that you've been assisting with research with UNSW on experiences with rent negotiation. Do you think that COVID has kind of, as you said, functioned as a bit of a watershed moment for revealing that sort of precarity between like the tenant-landlord connection as well?
I think it has. I think it's something those of us working in housing research have been saying for a very long time. But I think the pandemic has possibly made a few more people listen to the things that we've been saying. There's obviously been more widespread housing problems. So people who previously maybe didn't have issues paying their rent or their mortgages are now experiencing those, and perhaps will be more sympathetic, I should say, to those who were previously in a similar situation. But the response from state and federal government has not really reflected the severity of the issues that have resulted from the pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic has provided a hopefully once-in-a-generation opportunity to fix the structural and systemic problems of housing that have always been here in Australia.
I understand a lot of your research has been focused on public housing and the stigma against people in these facilities. Do you feel that COVID has also uniquely affected people who are living in these spaces?
I think there are a couple of ways in which the pandemic has had impacts, disproportionate impacts on public housing tenants. We saw this obviously in Melbourne with the lockdown of towers in Kensington and North Melbourne. That was completely unlike the response to outbreaks in other areas of Melbourne where there was high density housing. So tenants were given no notice, so no forewarning that they were going to be locked down, and their lockdown was far more strict than what it was in other areas. So that response is clearly one that is exceptional to public housing. And I think that probably stems from some ideas about public housing tenants as being either incapable of responding to more lenient government restrictions, or in fact, maybe some people think that they don't deserve to be treated the same way as people in private housing might have been.
Just speaking on that first issue there, where do you think that sort of characterization of those living in public housing, where does that come from?
Yeah, there are a few dimensions to that. There's a belief that public housing tenants are uniquely subsidized, that public housing is a uniquely subsidized housing tenure. That really ignores the fact that there are subsidies for home ownership, especially in many different ways. So through the various tax settings for home ownership that encourage investment. So for example, non-taxation of imputed rents, capital gains tax discounts, negative gearing, and so on. These are all kinds of subsidies for home ownership or investor ownership of housing. But that's not really talked about. Public housing tenants are seen as uniquely subsidized. And when they are seen to be undeserving that subsidy, so for example, when they're portrayed as lazy or as feckless because they maybe are out of work, or if they are suffering from drug addictions, then they're often portrayed by politicians and the media as not deserving the subsidies that they get from governments. The other issue, which is perhaps a little bit beneath the surface, is the issue of housing quality. Public housing is not always, but quite often, quite poorly maintained, and with people spending more time in their homes, those issues of maintenance and in fact also the cost of housing. So if you have old electricity and water systems, that becomes more expensive, and the experience of living in your home is less pleasant and really, for some people, really quite dangerous. Public housing estates in inner cities, which are often high density, are disparaged as quote-unquote suicide towers. So the particular kind of built environment there is being disparaged as a place where life is so miserable that there's disproportionate for number of suicides, for example. I think probably more widespread in kind of housing policy and housing discourse is the notion of concentrated disadvantage. So concentrated disadvantage is the idea that the concentration of disadvantaged people, of marginalized people in one area actually exacerbates their disadvantage through various reasons.
This extreme precarity of social housing relates back to a neoliberal housing process known as residualization. Pre-COVID, we sat down with Dr. Andrew Clark to give us a bit of background about what this process looks like.
So my research is on the governance of social housing, looking particularly at the management of, problem social housing tenants or problem tenancies. And so the work that I've been doing most recently has been trying to examine that process, that governmental process, in the context of broader changes to housing policy, social housing policy, and what we've called a sort of style of bureaucratic encounter that housing authorities engage in order to manage tenants. The broader context is important because neoliberal housing policy has led to what's referred to as the residualisation of social housing in Australia. So this is a combination of declining investment relative to population in social housing, which has led to a dwindling of stock, accompanied with an increasing targeting of that stock towards those individuals who have the highest needs. So in order to get into social housing in Australia now, you don't just have to be struggling to afford housing in the private rental sector or private market. You also need to be able to demonstrate that you have other associated sort of complex needs that contribute to your inability to sustain housing. And they're things like mental illness, substance abuse, substance addictions, experience of incarceration, experience of domestic violence, all of these kind of things that make people's lives complicated, I guess, and make it difficult for people to sustain housing outside of the social housing sector. As a consequence of this residualization process, now we have a concentration of some of the sort of most vulnerable and disadvantaged people in society concentrated within a sort of a quite small social housing sector. And they're concentrated in terms of tenure, but they're also concentrated spatially because that housing is often spatially concentrated, right? So there's, you know, big apartment blocks and that kind of stuff. And so what this means is that social housing providers are faced with a kind of disproportionate or a large volume of tenancy issues, right? So you have people with complex needs all thrown in together. And I guess this leads to the kinds of tenancy problems that I was talking about earlier. So we have lots of disputes between neighbours. We have a lot of issues with rent arrears, property damage, all of this kind of stuff, right? That's kind of a product of putting all the people with complex needs together in one place. And so the kind of response to that, and what we've sort of conceptualized as the kind of neoliberal response to that, is to sort of focus on the individual and say, well, this is because these individuals are irresponsible and they're not, you know, behaving themselves properly. They're taking advantage of the welfare system. They're taking advantage of social housing. Therefore, in order to address these issues, we need to make their housing conditional on improvements in their behavior. And so in Queensland, this manifests itself under the Newman government as what was called the antisocial behavior management policy. And this entailed a three strikes and you're out approach, which basically entailed that if you had three breaches against your tenancy, or a first and final, they called it, which was a particularly bad one, which was things like the housing provider discovered a meth lab in your house, you would be evicted, right? And so this was kind of premised on the idea that these people were just rational subjects, the same as anybody else, and they were making bad decisions, or they were irresponsible and they refused to get their lives on track. And it sort of ignored the very conditions that the state itself placed on people in order to get into social housing, which is that you had to demonstrate this array of complex needs, right? And this has implications for those people in that it exacerbates their kind of vulnerabilities by, you know, clustering people with complex mental illnesses, drug and alcohol addictions together. You can imagine that's not a recipe for a harmonious community necessarily. And it also has led to the stigmatization of the sector. So wonderful publications like the Courier Mail or the Daily Telegraph do exposés on, you know, the badly behaved social housing tenants. And so there's a broader public perception that social housing is messed up and why do we even do it and these people don't even deserve it. And this feeds back into the delegitimization of social housing as a tenure option.
So, Alistair, back to you. So I was just wondering, what key issues in the rental market have you noticed since COVID-19?
Mm-hmm. Well, the obvious issue is that it's highlighted the severe precarity of our private rental system. We knew already that a lot of people were living in immense housing stress, people paying more than 30% of their income, sometimes more than 50% of their incomes in rent. And of course, when those people lose work, that situation becomes completely untenable. And so they have to start negotiating with their landlords if their landlords are willing to give them either a deferral of their rent or a reduction in their rent. Or in many cases, they have to terminate their lease and perhaps move in with their parents. Or in some unfortunate cases, people have been made homeless.
When we were down at Matavai, we ran into someone called Henry, who was quite the character. And Henry was previously homeless, and he spoke to us about his experience being homeless and the benefits of having a home in Matavai and the safety and security that came with that, particularly during the pandemic.
So, sorry, could you introduce yourself?
My name is Henry. I live in the Matavai, and I'm quite happy where I am. But it's so good here because we're so central at everything. You've got the bus if you want to go to Marrickville Metro, just there. You're 10 minutes from the train station. You've got Woolies 5 minutes away. Wham, bang, thank you, ma'am. How good do you want it? Apart that COVID has sort of got to everybody, not only me, being isolated, locked up, you know, when I'm used to getting out and meeting people and getting out. But we just got to pray to God that it's coming to an end.
With COVID, what was the regulation? Were you not allowed out at all?
No. Well, at one time, we'd be isolated for 2 weeks. You know, there's a lot of old people here and they get very sick and they don't come out much, you know, because we're all old. Look at me grey hairs, I cover them up.
Can I ask what your age is, sorry?
Well, I'm 76. In another month, I'll be 77, not out. Pray to God.
And were you worried being in that age range? I mean, obviously people were affected by COVID a lot.
No, it didn't worry me. I knew what the rules and regulations was.
And were you told why you had to all isolate for 2 weeks?
Yes, because of the virus. And we didn't want... Because once you get in a building like that, as you know, it has spread right through the building. And as I said, there's a lot of old people there.
Can I ask how long you've lived here as well, sorry?
Over 4 years.
Were you in any other public housing before that?
No, I was homeless. I was sleeping at Central like a lot was. I got bashed a couple of times. And the housing used to come there from 6:30 in the morning and they seen the condition I was in. So they put me into a place at Surrey Hill, into a motel, until such time as I got this. They got me a fridge. They got me a bed. They got me everything I wanted. They said, hey, you didn't get nobody to tuck me in. But, you know, things like that, that was excellent, you know what I mean?
I think one of the things that was really interesting about talking to Henry and Catherine down at Matavai was how tight the community is and how much they look out for each other. And I don't know about you, but I've lived in 2 apartments now in Sydney and I don't know any of my neighbours' names and I never have and I never would feel comfortable asking them for a teaspoon of sugar or anything like that. But down at Matavai, they all knew each other and they all really cared for each other.
Yeah, for sure. And it definitely went against a lot of the media narratives that we hear about public housing, especially like Catherine mentioned in outlets like the Daily Telegraph and whatnot. They can often misconstrue public housing and public housing tenants as drug addicts and just welfare slobs, when in reality they're like a very vibrant community that are often still working or have conditions which don't allow them to work as well. So a lot of these people are just, as you said, living in a really positive, tight-knit community. And you don't often get that recognition that they probably deserve as well.
But also a lot of them do work. As Catherine said, she works, but she just doesn't get paid for it. And she does a lot of volunteer-based work as well. But I think that yeah, they're a community that we can look up to as to how we can do housing better and how we can look after our neighbours better and look after our community better.
Yeah, that was another element where I asked both Catherine and Henry about whether they were scared about it spreading through the building, and both of them said that they weren't too scared because they trusted their neighbours to follow all of the regulations, to wear a mask, to stay distance, and they just trusted their neighbours to do that. They weren't too worried about people going against the rules because they knew them and they knew how important this was.
Time to introduce you to the wonderful,
the truly sublime
Twissia 107.3.